This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Bassam Salem, the founder of Mindshare Ventures. Until a few months ago, Bassam was the chief operating officer at MeritCX, a technology firm in the fast-growing space of customer surveys. MeritCX is headquartered in Utah. It has revenues north of $200 million, and believe it or not, it employs over 2,000 people. Normally, our conversations with a guest like Bassam would be about his experiences there at MeritCX. However, that's not the game plan for today. MeritCX is just one in a string of interesting and profitable experiences for Bassam. His other experiences include being a senior executive at some of Utah's largest and most exciting companies, firms like InContact, Siebel Systems, and Omniture. Join me this morning to hear Bassam's outlook on life, on business, and on human connections. I suspect there are several life lessons that all of us can learn and end up leading a richer and more rewarding lives. Bassam, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Doug, I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
So I put a little bit of pressure on you. Yeah. I normally don't say there's life lessons that we can all learn from our guest. You and I have known each other several years. I know my wife had a very interesting conversation with you on a plane one day, and I have also watched your TEDx talk.
Thank you.
And so I say that because I think you're a very thoughtful individual, and you do give good advice based on years of experience and just your life journey. And so I want to first ask, do you think there's some truth in kind of that outlook? And my view is it's important to you to share some of these life lessons with others. Is that fair?
So first, my gosh, you've set a high bar for what I'm supposed to do today. But I do think that's fair, Doug. It's funny because when I was younger, I thought of myself as an engineer and a mathematician. I liked numbers. I liked the hard sciences. My mother was an electrical engineer, and I thought of myself as sort of following in her footsteps. I was going to be a computer scientist. And the older I've gotten, certainly starting at probably age 30, the more I've realized that I actually have an inner social scientist like my father, who has a PhD in economics and a PhD in political science. So he's the consummate social scientist and humanities person. And I find myself wanting to understand less about the hard sciences and more about what makes humanity tick. What runs the world, what we don't understand socially, and perhaps being an immigrant, that sort of motivates me to understand those sorts of things. I'm a bit more empathetic than I would otherwise be because of my being an immigrant here.
I suspect it's also driven that big move that I mentioned in the open, right? You were at MeritCX. You were with several very successful, very large technology companies. And now you've made the decision that the next chapter of your life, and that's a phrase I use often.
Absolutely.
When you announced, you sent out an email to friends and colleagues and said, this is what my new venture is. This is what my new opportunity is. You used the term the next chapter in my life. And I was caught by that because I really like using that phrase as well. Tell us about what this next chapter is and why it's important to you.
I really appreciate that question. I and you are completely correct that this decision was different than every other professional decision I had taken to this point. I feel that since I arrived in this country at age 13, just before my 14th birthday, that I had really prioritized doing what immigrants are supposed to do and what your parents as immigrants expect you to do, which is to go to school and work hard and get a great job and work harder at that job and get a bigger job and just be responsible financially. You know, do what this country is based on immigrants, and do what all immigrants have done, which is work hard and save money. So it's basically focus on professional and financial goals. And I feel, if I'm completely blunt about it, that has always been what I'd considered. I feel I'd try to do the right things that would make my immigrant parents proud. This is the first time where I feel that the motivation was not financial. The motivation was not professional. In fact, I'm very confident that professionally and financially, I'd be better off in 2016 at Merit CX, a great company, great team. But I really needed this for myself. I really needed to try what it was like for a year or two to do what actually made me, what I was passionate about and what made me very personally happy.
And let's talk about what you've decided to do.
So as I considered, what in my life professionally, aside from my family, which is obviously very meaningful to me, but from a professional perspective, what was most fulfilling over the last few years, I realized that I thoroughly enjoyed the few moments I spent with small startups whose advisory boards I sat on. I absolutely loved getting in with a small team of entrepreneurs and helping them figure out what's going on and what's broken and how they can scale and how to position their business. And I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And maybe I should have been a professor after all, which, by the way, was the path I was on academically. I did 3 degrees in computer science expecting to be a professor. And as a quick aside, I jokingly say that immigrant parents always say, "Son, I'll be proud of you. You can be whatever you want to be, but I certainly would be really proud if you're a professor or a doctor." You know, it's the sort of the two paths that
right.
an immigrant looks up to. So that I gave up on academics when I went to the private sector, but I still have to admit I have that need to absorb concepts, absorb ideas, consolidate them, organize them, and then educate, and then coach.
And how important is that last piece, the educating and coaching side? As I talk to, you know, I'm in my early 50s, and as I talk to my friends, as we age, it's more and more important to all of us to kind of give back and to educate. And we kind of feel in many ways we've fought our battles. And it was a fun experience, and it wasn't, you know, all fun and games. But there's a lot of contentment that comes from fighting a big battle, working with a team, overcoming a big challenge, and coming through the other end of it, fortunately, more often successfully than not, but sometimes not. And sharing that experience and helping other people with their battles. I hear my friends talk about this a lot, which makes me proud of who the people I'm friends with.
That was such an insightful question, Doug, because you had two different angles on it, both of which resonate so much with me. The first is, you're right, as I age, the desire to coach and the fulfillment from coaching and helping is substantial. But you brought up another question or another phrase, the expression give back. The older I get, the more I realize how normal I am and how fortunate I am to be here. And I feel a sense of obligation to all of those folks where it may not have been quite as fortunate as me. I feel an obligation to give back. And, you know, we can talk more about that at some point, but I really do have that sense of good fortune.
Yeah, and let's do talk more about that. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Bassam Salem, the CEO and founder of Mindshare Ventures, as well as a serial entrepreneur in several of Utah's most successful companies. You mentioned feeling a sense of obligation. You know, it's interesting. You and I both live in Park City. I moved there in 2006, so about a decade now. And the town was really interesting in several aspects. One is we really view ourselves as a community. And I grew up in Cleveland. I would have said Cleveland viewed itself as a community, but more so Park City than any place I've lived. And part of what gives us that flavor, and at first I thought it was bizarre for a town of 10,000 people, we have 100-plus not-for-profit firms. And when I first moved to town, so many of my neighbors were involved in these different not-for-profits. It was every other weekend we were getting invited to a fundraiser. And at first, that made me a little uncomfortable because it was just new to me. Now it's part of what makes my community, my neighborhood special. It's one of the things I really cherish about it. And at first, I felt a sense of obligation. And now it's not obligation. It's just this yearning to want to give back. And I'm not quite sure what drove that change. What do you think drove that change in your outlook, where it was really, it was such a powerful force you couldn't ignore it, and now it's your life's work?
I think a relatively monumental event in my life, and it was actually the topic of my TEDx Salt Lake City talk, was when I went back to Egypt as for the first time as an American, having not been there for 25 years, and without re-delivering my talk, my breath was taken away by how different life and society was there than I had quickly grown to expect, thanks to our media and thanks to our perceptions and thanks to our relative isolation from the rest of the world. I was taken aback by how, quote-unquote, normal people were, how similar they were to people in our neighborhoods in Park City or elsewhere. It dawned on me that for the vast majority of humanity, what drove us on a day-to-day basis was fundamentally a very similar thing, which is opportunity for our children, opportunity for ourselves, an opportunity to improve our lives, a sense of if I work hard, I can do better, I can be better. And I think in the U.S. we're sort of we have this perception that others may dislike us or may dislike freedom or may dislike whatever, that they're fundamentally different. And it was so breathtaking how untrue that was as I saw these people. Many of whom are so poor that we have no concept of it. They're very poor people. Yet despite that, they're still focused on their children. They're still focused on how hard they can work in one day so as their children hopefully could have a better life than they would. That was so moving to me that it's really driven this sort of sense of you're right. It's not obligation as much as it is some sort of yearning, as some sort of internal satisfaction or satiation.
It's a beautiful thing that when I was in my 30s and saw people in their 50s giving back, I didn't fully comprehend or appreciate. And when I first started experiencing that personally, it's invigorating. It's a very powerful thing. And frankly, it's a beautiful thing as I see how it's transformed some of my friends as well as myself. It's a beautiful thing, and it's a wonderful thing that that's part of the human experience, which really your TED Talk was about, the human experience. I want to wrap up at the end of the interview talking about your TED Talk, but yeah. You know, in brief, I summarize it as the importance of building bridges as opposed to tearing them down, and I'm paraphrasing several things that you put in there. But let's set that aside, because the world's becoming a more divisive place, not less. And as you point out in your TED Talk, what unites us is much greater than what the small differences that separate us. And I think that's a nice thing to close with. So going back to Egypt was a piece of your journey that opened your eyes and changed your outlook. Let's talk about some of your professional experiences that also influenced who you are today and your desire to give back, as well as some of the outlooks, the viewpoints that you have. So you mentioned your CS major, 3 CS degrees. That's quite impressive. And when you were doing it, it wasn't the tech industry was not the darling it is today. You left the University of Utah, had several jobs with some Fortune 500 companies. You were at IBM. And then in the late 1990s, you joined Siebel Systems.
Yes.
And Siebel was the fastest of the fast-growing companies. As crazy as the internet boom was in the 1999s, in the entire country, the fastest-growing company was Siebel Systems. You joined, I believe, in late 1999. The bubble burst in March 2000, 2 or 3 months after you joined. You left a stable, secure job. a company your parents knew, all your friends knew, probably Siebel Systems, while they were a darling, a lot of people didn't know. What was that like to have given up the safety and comfort of IBM and all of a sudden see the entire tech world crumbling around you?
I have to admit, it was not as painful as 2008 and 2009 were, because in 2001, while it was financially painful for those who had lots of assets locked up in the industry, I think professionally, it almost felt like a cleansing of the market. That is, everyone had become a programmer in 2001 or 2002 because there's so much demand. And you could argue that it was a bit of a cleansing of the market. But let me pile on your comment about Siebel Systems, because to this day, while I love and respect the teams with whom I've worked at every other company, Siebel Systems still stands as the epitome of a well-run company after all of these years.
Which is no longer a standalone company,
absolutely,
right?
It's owned by Oracle. Exactly. So I joined when it was roughly 2,000 employees, and after year one, we were 4,000. After year two, we were 8,000, and then the bubble collapsed. But what an engine of top-notch talent recruiting that company was. Just phenomenal people in Utah and elsewhere hired to be part of Siebel. And I'm still very, very friendly and connected to many of the folks whose careers were built at Siebel many years ago.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Bassam Salem, the CEO and founder of Mindshare Ventures. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Bassam Salem, the CEO and founder of Mindshare Ventures, as well as a serial entrepreneur who's worked with some of the largest and most successful companies here in Utah, one of which we were talking about just before break, Siebel Systems. That's quite a kudo that you give to the company. Thomas Siebel was the founder there. Obviously, the culture, he gets a lot of credit for building that. I want to lay the groundwork. We haven't talked about it yet, but you also worked at Omniture. And in my opinion, Josh James is one of the best entrepreneurs, not just in Utah, but in the nation.
Absolutely.
So your reflection on Siebel and the respect you have for them, given the benchmark of also Omniture, is quite a high benchmark. What was it that made Siebel different? What was it that impressed you there?
That is a fair comment, because Omniture was as close to a Siebel experience as I've ever had. I mean, I think today, as I look at talent in Utah, talent that I admire and would draw upon, many of them would come from Omniture. Many of them cut their teeth at Omniture. So that is very true, and it's really hard to compare the two, perhaps because when I joined Omniture, we were maybe 100 employees, 80, 90, 100 employees, and I saw that growth from 100 to the 14, 15, 1600 employee count before being acquired by Adobe, whereas Siebel was already 2,000 employees at the time. So there are actually quite a few commonalities. Certainly the one that I take away from both is the focus on top talent. At both companies, top talent was critical, and that is a takeaway that I now to this day use, which is I'd much rather have two A-plus players than 10 B-plus players.
Particularly important in a startup, because you don't get many do-overs.
Exactly. And this perhaps digs in a little too quickly, tactically, into building software engineering teams and some best practices there. But I one of the biggest mistakes I see software companies making is investing in product, quote-unquote, investing in product by quadrupling and quintupling engineering team sizes as quickly as possible, when I think the scale and overhead and complexity that's inherited from that may not be as effective as simply sticking with a small team that does more. It's amazing to me what 6 or 7 brilliant engineers can do vis-a-vis a team of 120 with 300 overseas.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. I consider myself a student of culture and what makes companies successful. And I'm particularly interested in large companies that are able to get incredible amounts of technology and innovation done. It becomes increasingly difficult as the team gets larger. You look at companies like Apple, huge student of Steve Jobs. You look at companies like Google, where there's not that figurehead there, but the organization. If you look at what Google has done and all the innovation, the self-driving cars, the Gmail of the world, the Google Forms, I mean, just so many things I interact with on a daily basis. Making the decision to come up with a smartphone operating system, which essentially is, you know, number one and number two with Apple. How does a company of that scale not only come up with these great ideas, but execute on them and beat small startups? And Google uses a technique that they call sprints, very small teams, very short timelines, 5 days. You have access to anybody, but you've only got 5 days to build the prototype. And I think that's brilliant.
Brilliant, absolutely. It seems that at some point, and I don't know exactly what that point is, it's somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 employees. It makes sense to almost treat your business as multiple standalone businesses.
That's a pretty high benchmark, though, 1,000 people. At that point, you've essentially you've beaten the odds. You're a successful company. I would have thought you'd say closer to 50 to 100 that you have to start divvying things up and making sure you're still small, hungry teams.
You know, that may be optimal, Doug. That's
you'll
a
find out
point.
In your new venture, right?
Exactly. Right. I know that lots of research has shown that groups of humans up to about 140 or 150 is sort of an optimal clan or an optimal tribe, and it's at that point that you should consider splitting up. But these days where you hire armies of sales and marketing teams and armies of services folks and with virtual teams now, which is becoming increasingly prevalent, you're not all in one location. I think that number could substantially understate the size.
You know, use the term army, and it's amazing how many of these core management principles stand the test of time. For instance, the size of your team. You know, I find 5 to at most 10, one person can effectively interact and manage with and be a part of that team. And actually Julius Caesar, 2,000 years ago, is the one that really came up with this rule of 7. None of his army generals, should have more than 7 direct reports. Isn't that fascinating?
That's interesting. That 2,000 years,
it was as true then as it is today. We have a lot of tools to help us communicate more. But as far as direct reports, I think it's because of that personal relationship that's so important. So you were at Siebel. Sounds like you really enjoyed your time there. It was a great experience. You learned a lot. You worked with other smart people. And you had left IBM to do this experience. Now you make the decision to go work for a relatively small firm called
Attensity. Yes.
Basically big data analytics, which is a very hot spice now. 2003, that term probably didn't even exist in 2003. How did you make the decision to leave Siebel and go join a relatively small company?
Great question. So and it was a tough decision. That was before the decision I recently made, this was probably the next milestone. So you're really good, Doug, at picking the sort of milestone decisions.
Life is hard. You know, I've gone through enough of it that I know when you're at these inflection points, those are hard decisions. And they do materially impact the rest of your life. The decisions matter.
Absolutely. My wife had recently delivered our first son. And at the time, working at Siebel, I ran the Northwest Consulting services for the company. So I was gone Monday through Friday pretty much every week. And within a few months of my son's birth, I recognized that when I came home on a Friday night, and he wouldn't recognize me at first, and it would take until Saturday or, you know, midday Saturday before I felt close to him again and he could recognize me. It was a pretty quick decision that I could no longer be on the road. And it was difficult for me because at the time, the opportunities in Utah just paled in comparison to the opportunities in the Bay Area working for a company like Siebel. So it was a tough decision. I had a good friend at the time, David Bean, Dr. David Bean now, where we went to a graduate school together. We studied for the PhD comprehensive exams together. And he had founded Attensity, co-founded Attensity with a couple of other colleagues based on that research. And you're absolutely right. Talk about being 5 to 10 years too early, because it's brilliant technology, just way before the market was ready to accept it. So we grew the company. We did quite well given the circumstances. But certainly, had it been founded 5 years later, it would have materialized very differently than it
Yeah, I saw that they, I believe it was 2 years ago, closed a just under $100 million round of private equity financing. So they were way early, but their day in the sun has come.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So one of the things when I was researching kind of your journey, you mentioned a patent that you had come up with while you were at Attensity that was kind of core to what they do. Tell us about what that patent was and what it allows users to do.
I'll keep it rather simplistic because, frankly, I'm simplistic as it pertains to this concept, but Attensity's technology was based on very sophisticated linguistic, quote-unquote, knowledge engineering. That's what we called it back then. So I had a team of linguists from the University of Utah, mostly with graduate degrees, who were trained on our technology and literally configured the system to be able to extract the grammatical components of a sentence. So the output was a parsing, an English language parsing grammatically of sentences. What that meant is the output that you received was pretty complicated. What do you do now with actions, verbs, actions that are verbs, the direct object, the subject, and now you're trying to connect. So this person is doing this. Is that what this means? It was very complicated. Fantastic in terms of being able to parse, not fantastic in terms of being able to actually present it to a human being to do something with it. So what we did is develop a very simplistic concept called a fact. And a fact was just a thing and something that thing did. So if you're talking
a noun and a verb.
Exactly. A noun and a verb or a noun and an adjective, it became, you see, we started disconnecting the parts of speech from what we're trying to actually extract. So a warped rotor on a car, for example, was a concept. That's a fact. And simplistically, we know that fact exists in this sentence. So we would pull these facts out and then tie them together in relationships. So if this fact caused this other fact, there'd be a causality relationship. So some sort of dependence.
And was that valuable? I can see applications in search, Google search, you know, how do I do this? And so it's nouns and actions and trying to parse what the human typed in and then do a search on relative aspects of a database.
Absolutely. Or to continue the theme I just started with the warped rotors, imagine if you're an OEM maker of cars, and I will leave the actual customer names out of it, but a maker of cars that has a lot of warranty claims from the dealers across the country. And as you know, when you take your car in to have it repaired, they type in what the symptom was, what you as the customer tell them. They type that in. And then when they remediate it or fix it, they type in what they did. Well, inherently, we now know that there's a connection between these two things. When customers complain about this, 83% of the time, the remediation was that. And if we can capture the facts in both of those two sides of the equation in a big data sort of way, now we know this concept of big data, then we can potentially help educate a service technician who goes in and says, the customer said this. Now the computer can calculate and say, well, when facts 2, 3, and 4 show up, there's a very good chance to you should check this. This could be a problem.
You know, I think the reason the blurb on the patent as I was preparing for the interview kind of caught my attention and said this could be something interesting to chat about was it seemed you had left the world of being a deliverer, an inventor of technology yourself, and instead were leading teams and helping that happen. So did you, when you were at Attensity, did you go back to your technical roots or were you still high-level management and helping teams succeed?
You know, I ran the services organization for Attensity, but one benefit of being the person who's responsible for implementing the technology is you end up knowing two things that are absolutely critical to tie together. One is you talk to the customer all of the time, so you know the problem that the customer is trying to solve. And second, because you and your team are responsible for configuring and deploying the product, you know it at a much more fundamental user level than does the engineer even who is developing that product. So that expertise came together, and I was fortunate enough to sort of start seeing the gaps between the product that was being built and the need that the customer had, and that gap could be crossed by taking the sophisticated information that came out of the system, trying to simplify it, and then present it in a way that answered the customer's question. So you're right. I did sort of return to a product role for about a year there, where I kept my existing team, but then I was essentially the chief product guy at the company.
I suspect that was fun for you because leading teams to get things done, sometimes it's fun to go back to being an individual contributor as well.
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Bassam Salem, the CEO and founder of Mindshare Ventures. Bassam has also worked for several of Utah's most successful startup companies, one of which is Omniture. So you were at Attensity for several years. You left Attensity to go work for Omniture. It sounds like Omniture was about 100 people at the time. That is a name that is very familiar to the audience here in Utah. As we mentioned earlier, sold for over $1 billion to Adobe. Huge success. Has also delivered not just a financial win for investors and for employees, but also provided Utah with a base of experienced entrepreneurs, experienced business people that have gone on, the alumni, yourself included, to help the next generation. So how did you find out about Omniture, and what was it that you said, you know what, this looks really interesting?
You know, the interesting thing is it goes back to a Siebel connection. So a colleague of mine from my Siebel days, Don Cash, who's quite a luminary in Utah, fantastic sales leader. Don.
I know Don. He's on the board of one of my startup companies, and I'm very glad that he has the startup's demo chimp.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I'm very glad Don's involved there.
Fantastic guy. Don reached out. So Don ran inside sales at Siebel, and I was the consulting guy working out of the same office who ran the services piece. So I would work with his sales folks, and we would implement Siebel implementations. Anyway, so we had worked together at Siebel for a few years. Don reached out to me after having just joined Omniture, and I can't remember what the email said, but something to the effect, you have got to see what Josh James, John Pastana, and this company is doing. It's absolutely amazing. We need someone to run implementation services. You would be perfect for it. Just come and chat. And I still remember the young man who was Josh James at that point. A very different Josh James than people think of today. He was unbelievably humble, unbelievably.
Really? That was not the word I was expecting to say.
And that's why I say it, because Josh's, the interview I had with Josh was key to my taking the job. Because I
Tell us more. What did you see in Josh, and what drew you towards him? Because that's important for any entrepreneur, is to draw talented people, not just to the company, but you're choosing the leader, you're choosing the CEO as well.
I saw more than just a humility at the time. I mean, obviously, he was a confident person. You can't get to where he is today without being confident. But he showed a humility, and I'll tell you the exact phrase that I still remember in that interview. Because at the time, he was representing a relatively unknown name, and he's trying to attract
very much so unknown at the time.
Exactly. He was just a young guy with a young company that's in Utah County. Yet he is charged with attracting people like Don Cash and other phenomenal leaders that ultimately joined the company. I remember Josh saying, hey, Bassam, in another life, our roles could completely be reversed. I could be sitting in your seat, and you could be sitting in my seat. It's circumstance that puts me here. And I remember sort of seeing that humanity, that humility in him, and thinking, this is a guy I want to work for. And this is a company I want to be a part of. One thing I learned at IBM that I truly believe to this day is it only takes 6 months for a company to take on the persona of its CEO. I truly believe that. And so if you believe in the CEO, you can believe in the company.
It is amazing how one person, how a handful of people can have a dramatic impact, not just on a small company, but on a large company. And in my work in the investment world, I work for a wealth management firm, and we do research on stocks. And it is, you do a management change and the new manager doesn't have the skill set that the previous manager does, that can have devastating impacts, like you say, fairly quickly. Likewise, you get the right person in and you can turn things around very quickly.
Absolutely. I think the CEO is ultimately responsible for the quote-unquote culture, what we say. We use that word so loosely these days, but the culture of a company mimics the CEO's. If it's divisive, I dare say the CEO adopts a divisive culture with his or her executive team, which then trickles down to the rest of the company.
That was a little risky for you. I mean, we like I said, I'm a huge fan of Josh's, right? A huge number of strengths.
Yeah.
Also, now that he's been a successful CEO for over a decade, people know if you go work for one of Josh James's company, you're going to work hard.
Absolutely.
And if you're trying to balance work and family, that can be challenging. In 2003, when you joined, Josh had just been running the company 3 or 4 years. It wasn't as easy to decipher that. Did you know that it was going to be as intense of a work environment as it was? And how did you think about balancing that work life that we talked about earlier?
Having come from Siebel only a few years earlier, and that was exactly the same culture.
Very intense culture.
Oh my gosh, it's very difficult. A very difficult place to be. But as a young person, it fills you with energy because everyone around you is working hard. And as long as you feel that way, you feel like you've got a purpose and that you're making a difference. And I felt that at Omniture. We were all working hard. It's not like some folks weren't carrying their weight. And then ultimately, because it was in Utah, it was still fantastic for me. So I was more than happy to work hard as long as I didn't have to get on a plane every single week. Although, as my wife reminds me, driving from Park City to Orem 5 times a week was almost as bad as traveling.
Although there again, it's a relative point, right? Your commute was 50 minutes at most an hour.
54 minutes, exactly.
If you lived in the Bay Area,
yeah,
mostly your that's neighbors true. Would have at least an hour commute. And I think that's an important point. We mostly talk to Utah entrepreneurs. We talked to Parker Conrad, who's the CEO of Zenefits out in the Bay Area. But we kind of lose sight to what your A game needs to be here in Utah and what's asked of you when you're on an intense team versus the Bay Area. And there's probably exceptions, but the most intense companies here in Utah that I've seen, still give you more time to be with your family. I think it's just so ingrained in the culture here that family time is important. You know, my friends in the Bay Area, when they were building companies in the late 90s, early 2000s, I mean, they take their sleeping bag to work because there were many a days they slept at work because it wasn't worth the hour drive home and the hour drive back. So just that reference to what it means to compete and give 100% here in Utah, I think it's healthy for us to know that when we're giving 100%, somebody in the Bay Area, and this might be controversial, and Ross, who's our producer, we might get some people texting in. I have the utmost respect for the entrepreneurs here, but know that we're competing in a world marketplace. And there are, for every smart entrepreneur here, and this is going to circle back to your investing company, you know, how do you choose the entrepreneurs and the ideas that you back? You know, one of my, if it's a great idea, that's important. But there's no shortage of great ideas. And if somebody here has a great idea, you know, in all likelihood, there's somebody in the Bay Area that has that same great idea. There's somebody on the East Coast that has that great idea. And there's a team of people sleeping on a couch in somebody's crowded two-bedroom apartment, eating ramen noodles and working 18, 20 hours a day to bring it to reality. So when you meet Utah entrepreneurs, great idea, how do you decide, you know, which of the entrepreneurs to back?
There's certainly a work ethic to your point, but I do think there's a healthy balance between sort of burning time in an office and being productive in an office. And I don't know about you, Doug, but I'm glad this interview is happening at 10 in the morning, because as confused as I sound now, try me in 5 hours. There are points and points in the day and times of the day where we're at 100%. And then there are times in the day where I'm not so sure it's effective to just be sitting in front of a computer trying to eke out the last 20% of bandwidth out of one's brain. So mind you, I'm not disagreeing. Because we certainly don't want the other end of the spectrum, which is a lifestyle entrepreneur. I certainly don't want to invest in that, and I don't want to work with that, and I don't want to be that at this point.
Yeah, that's great for other folks, but then don't go out and ask for investment. If you want a lifestyle business, you should not seek outside capital, because it's not fair to the investor.
Absolutely. But there are, you know, companies like Merit CX, a local Utah company, and frankly, Omniture was not that dissimilar. I mean, we worked hard. We were on, but it's not as if we were expected to be there until 9 o'clock every night. There were certainly nights when we had to be. I really think there is a healthy strike of balance, and I hate to use the cliche of work-life balance, but a healthy strike of the number of hours in the day where we're productive, and then shut your brain off and rest it. So when you come back in the next morning, you're at 100% again, instead of spending the night there and just constantly being at 20%.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Getting to the point, and then we'll go back to your journey with these larger companies. Getting back to the point, what do you look for in an entrepreneur? Because a lot of younger people think having a great idea is the benchmark. And it's the minimum requirement to get into the arena.
Yeah.
So as you look at young people that are building companies, maybe folks pretty early, and I would imagine you're doing some early stage investing.
Yes.
Where oftentimes it is a dream and a team. How do you decide which one of those you want to back and which ones maybe you pass on?
So it's interesting, because for me, and mind you, I've right now I've only been doing this for 5 weeks,
but you've been involved in the startup community for many years.
Absolutely, but it's different to think of a company in which I'm going to invest financially versus a company, the model that I'm using today, in which I am going to be spending time with that entrepreneur and his or her executive team to try to build the company. So probably criterion number one for me at this point is, can I work with this person? Is there a rapport? Are we going to enjoy one another? And I have to admit, you know, we were part of Park City Angel Network for some time. And I remember one of the lessons learned for me there was, wow, it's amazing how people are one, buying the entrepreneur and not the idea. I don't know if you took the same takeaway from that, but it certainly felt that people were investing
in
the human.
Oh, sure, I do. Yeah. I invest in the person, not the idea.
Absolutely. And I remember us focusing so much on coachability. The word coachability kept coming up. And I tell you, that resonates with me so much now as I look at someone I'm partnering with, because the value I'm bringing is being able to coach him or her with some of the aspects that they may not know or not have experience with or not comfortable doing. So it's sort of rapport and coachability come way up, because you're right. Most of the ideas are actually great. As I've been talking to startups out there, it's not like we have all of these crazy, wacky ideas that could never materialize. There are some unbelievably viable business plans out there. So it's really around selecting one in which you can, when I'm supposed to go there and spend 4 hours today, it's something I'm excited about. It's someone I want to talk to, someone I want to be with, someone with whom we're going to take this battle on together. And we go up together, we go down together. And so it really is amazing how the interpersonal aspect of it drives so much more than the business and financial analysis.
Yeah,
aspect.
No, I can see that. You're investing something much more valuable than just capital. I mean, when you're investing your time, the decision set gets much more complicated very quickly. And we're going to come back to that. We're talking a little bit about just intensity of work here. And it's one of the things I try to remind entrepreneurs is, yeah, you're working hard, but know that you're competing against teams that are working every bit as hard as you are. So unfortunately, it's what you're signing up for when you decide you want to bring something into the world that doesn't exist today. It's really hard to do that. And unfortunately, you're competing against other people that are doing it. Obviously, Josh and his team, which included yourself, brought something great into the world, a very valuable service. You stayed at Omniture for several years, ultimately decided to leave and become the chief business officer at a company, I believe it was already publicly traded, called InContact. I'm a student of decision making. That must have been a really hard decision. You'd been in the crucible to create something great. You were there, I believe, during the 2008-2009 crisis.
Yes.
Which was tough for any team, and I'm sure you guys bonded through that. Why did you decide it was time to leave and join InContact?
So let me answer that question, but before I do, let me tell you an interesting tie back to Attensity. Just a couple of weeks ago, I understand that InContact acquired Attensity's IP that I worked on. So talk about a closing of the loop.
Missed that. Nugget.
It's kind of exciting. Yeah. And in fact, most of the folks who worked for me at the time and who are still there at Attensity now work for InContact, my alma mater. So it's a bit funny. Had I stayed at InContact, I would be managing those folks again. But it was in 2010 that I left to go to InContact. I think I was at Omniture 05 to 2010, if I'm not mistaken. And I had learned a lesson. And the lesson was, boy, do I love 100-person companies. Because 100-person companies are big enough to be legit, but small enough to be nimble and where you feel like you're a startup and you get to know everyone. At a 100-person company, I can know every single human being. By the time you're at 1,500, you're starting to walk the halls and see people you have no clue, and you don't even talk. The culture's very, very different. So after being acquired by Adobe, we had gone from, 100 to, say, 1,500 to instantly 9,000 overnight. And it was at that point that I realized Adobe's a fantastic company, by the way, but I yearned for the 100-person company again. So I actually defined that as a sort of parameter. I was going to look at opportunities that fit within the, say, 75 to 125 size, maybe 150, which mimics a lot of what Omniture was like when I joined. And at the time, InContact was exactly that. And it really, I have to tell you, I was right, for myself at least. I had a phenomenal cultural experience there. At InContact. And by the way, by the time I left InContact 5 years later, we had also surpassed 1,000 employees. I'm certain, I don't know what the latest count for InContact is, but I suspect it's 1,100 or 1,200 employees by now.
There is some irony, right? If you choose wisely, the 100-person company quickly becomes that 1,000-person company. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Bassam Salem, the CEO and founder of Mindshare Ventures, as well as you've heard through this interview, a senior executive at several of Utah's most successful companies. We've got the CEO of Merit's CX coming in a couple weeks. I know you had a great experience there as well. We're in the final phase of our time together today, so I'm going to skip that. We're going to have a chance to find out more about Merit CX in a couple weeks. And I want to circle back. I mentioned your TED Talk. One of the reasons I was excited about interviewing you is in many ways you're a Renaissance man. You're just involved in so many different things. And in my vocabulary, Renaissance man is a very high compliment.
That's very kind of you.
And so I want to talk to you about some of your life experiences. I mentioned earlier the TED Talk. We talked about your return trip to Egypt. We mentioned the world's becoming a more divisive place, not less. Talk to us about some of your thoughts about why we need to be focusing more on our similarities and why we need to be building bridges, not just here in the U.S. with one another, but throughout the world.
You know, I think it's especially critical for us as Americans to do what you just suggested, because it is amazing what two oceans on the eastern and western borders have done to us. We are relatively isolated, and because we're geographically isolated, I think we've been less exposed to a lot of cultural norms that may otherwise be pretty prevalent in places like London, Paris, Munich, any of Europe's major cities, which are geographically so close to the rest of the world.
Do you think the cultural acceptance in those major metropolitan areas in other places of the world are more accepting than we are here in the U.S.? My sense is not so. Paris has all kinds of tensions going on, obviously.
I think you're right. And part of the reason we came to the United States, now this was 1986, so the world is a very different place than it was in 1986, was for exactly the reason you mentioned, which is we felt that as non-Caucasians, Arabs, Middle Easterners who were coming here, who were emigrating, that the United States would give us the best opportunity to integrate, because we felt that this was the place where within a decade or two we could be Americans, we could be locals. And we truly believe that, and I still to this day believe that there's no better place for an immigrant to come if they can have the good fortune of coming here than the United States. Having said that, I think we, and this is the sad reality, I think we underestimate the degree to which racism and ethnocentricity remains in our country. And it's not just in Utah, but I think in our country as a whole. Certainly if you're talking about San Francisco or New York City, they're truly melting pots. But the remainder of the country, the vast area of this country is not New York City or San Francisco. And in those places, it is amazing. It is actually, including Utah, it's amazing the experiences that one has as a foreigner, that a native-born Caucasian European American may not experience. I certainly felt it in Utah, and I love this place. I live here. I want to live here.
You're raising your kids
here. I'm raising my kids here. But as I talked about in my talk, when I put my name, my legal name, my Egyptian name, Bassam Salem, on a resume in the 90s, in Utah or elsewhere, I would get almost no responses. And I'm not exaggerating. You know, after I thought it's crazy. I've worked hard. I have 3 degrees in computer science and MBA. Is it because it's the U? Is that why? You know, why is no one interviewing me? All it took was putting my nickname, which I wasn't. And by the way, the reason I hadn't put my nickname, which was Mark at the time. I can't even imagine myself as a Mark now. And we could talk about that
man
separately.
Man from Atlantis, yeah, as I recall from your TED Talk.
Do you actually know the show? Most people don't recognize that show. But yeah, it was big in Egypt. Mark Harris, Man from Atlantis. All it took was putting that nickname on, which I wasn't sure if that would be breaking rules because it's not really my name. It's not on my passport or on my social security card. All it took was that, and I could get job interviews all over the place. That's a horrible fact. And that's not that far ago. It's not like we're talking about the 1920s. This is the 1990s. I'm sure things are better.
Probably fairly true still today.
You
know, one of the questions I ask guests is, you know, if they had a magic wand and could change this or that, you know, what would they change? Often it has to do with, you know, how could the Utah legislature, which I think is very supportive of the business environment, what could they do that would take it to the next step? In your case, I want to ask a derivation of that question. So if you had a magic wand, and let's start locally, you know, what could we do that would make the Utah a better place and more accepting and more focused on our similarities than our differences?
The good news is I think we're already doing it. The good news is the difference between Y2K Utah and 2016 Utah is unbelievable. I mean, the amount of infusion of outside ideas and the degree to which I think Utahns accept outsiders is fantastic. So I dare say we're already doing it. So the only thing I could ask is, could we do it faster? Could we be just a little friendlier? Could we be just a little bit more accepting of those from the outside? And it's hard to legislate that. You know, I don't
it
know
is.
How
you open. You know, you opened your TED Talk and asked your audience to close their eyes and visualize what somebody from the Middle East looks like and what they do on a daily basis, what their work is. And you challenge them to say, oftentimes this is probably pretty close to what many people imagine, and this is what the real world is. And there's that gap. And, you know, when it comes down to what's built, in my case, over 50 years inside of you, you know, that's a hard thing to change. It needs to change, but it's a hard thing to change. Why do you think Utah is different now? What experiences do you think have helped move people along on that continuum?
You know, certainly it's hard to say the word diversity in Utah because I think we would all chuckle, but the relative diversity in Utah today than the diversity that existed in 1986, I dare say it's 10x. I mean, I attended East High School for a couple of years before going to the University of Utah when I came here. And I jokingly say that back then it was me, the Egyptian kid, and the Indian kid, and the Mexican kid. And I think we were the three non-Caucasians, and that's about it.
Now, you didn't have a choice where you went to high school, right? That happens to be where your family lives.
Exactly.
You did have a choice where you went to college, and you chose to go to college here in Utah versus maybe going to the Bay Area or some other place that has more diversity. Why did you make that decision?
You know, I wish I could honestly say that I chose the University of Utah. It was the only legitimately viable option given my socioeconomic position at the time. So even going through my entire college experience, I had to ride a bike, and I lived in my parents' tiny apartment, and they helped pay for my tuition with their very, very limited means. I mean, we as a family of five all worked many part-time jobs to put money together and barely pay for our non-resident tuition. So, which by the way, as a foreigner, you're always paying non-resident tuition. It never becomes, you're never deemed a resident as a foreigner. So the University of Utah was really my only legitimate option, and I don't regret it at all. It was fantastic. but I could not have afforded to live elsewhere and pay for tuition.
And do you think, so I'm the first person in my family to go to college.
Wow.
My parents gave me $1,000 in 1982. Fortunately for me, and said, this is what we have, good luck.
Yeah.
Fortunately for me, 5-6 years before I was college aged, my parents said, look, you need to know. We don't have money to send you to college, and we hope you go to college, but you need to plan for that now. So I was able to do some things as a young adult to start saving up money, nowhere near enough. And I know that had an impact, a positive impact on the rest of my journey. Did you have a similar experience as well?
Absolutely. I wonder the same thing about my children. We're certainly not wealthy people, but my children are being raised as Americans in an American home, and with the prospects of college being very real, that's very, very different than the experience I had, or certainly my parents did. And I am concerned to what degree that shapes a human being, and how do you balance?
They have a very different life experience set than you have.
Absolutely. How do you balance trying to share with them the benefit that you've gained while maintaining that motivation, that ambition that hunger drives? And I it's a delicate topic for me. I really, it's one that my wife and I talk about all of the time. My father and mother's advice is always, do as much as you can for your children as soon as you can for your children, and feel good about that. But I do worry that access to that sort of thing will impact their future.
Yeah, no, it is challenging. And another question that tends to be one of my favorites is, you've learned a lot of lessons through life. You've shared a lot of lessons with entrepreneurs, with other business people, with junior members of your team that are going through different professional experiences. What lessons do you hope your kids have learned from you?
You know, I've always wondered if there were a word that I'd be most proud to be described with, what would it be? And I think that word would likely answer your question. I think that word is either authentic or sincere. If there's one compliment someone can give me, it's to say, you know, you're a very sincere person. You're a very genuine or authentic person. Everything I do is about that. I want to have real connections with people where there's no hidden motivation. There's just an authenticity of, I am with a human being because I'm interested in being with that human being, not because I need something, but because I want to be with that human being. And if I were to have my kids remember me for one thing, I hope and aspire to have them say that my father was a really authentic, a genuine human being.
You know, and kids are funny, though. They'll keep you honest. So if they don't feel that way,
they'll tell you.
They'll definitely let you know.
It's true.
Yeah, well, that's great advice. You know, one of the things I like to talk to my friends about, particularly those, Linda and I had our kids later in life, so I have friends that many of whom their kids have gone to college, and probably over half their kids are done with college. And I'm now entering the teenage years with my girls, and thank goodness they're very forgiving, because they're very different stages of parenting. And one of the things a couple years ago that as I talked to my friends about their experience parenting, and I had a friend use this phrase, and it kind of put together everything, which is, as the kids become more of teenagers, in hindsight, my friends wish they had been more of a cheerleader for their kids versus a policeman.
Interesting.
And you do have to kind of wear both hats
there. Yeah, yeah.
But that was, you know, that's some advice that my friends have shared with me. Frankly, I was surprised at how different it is parenting a teenager than a young child. I loved parenting young kids. I mean, you come home and you're just swimming in love. And that's not always the case with teenagers. I'm fortunate to have great kids. But that was a tough transition for me. So I'll just share that with
I don't know
how old your kids are, but I'll share that with you as well as the audience, because it's helped guide me through several tough times, if you will. So we talked about what you hope that the lessons your kids have learned. My last question for you kind of combines that with your TED Talk, which is paint a picture of the world that you hope your kids inherit from all of us.
You know, I'd love to imagine a world, and now I feel like I'm introducing a movie or something, but I'd love to imagine a world where our actions and only our actions determined people's perception of us. That is, not what we ate, not what our skin color was, not whether we were bald or not, not whether we were religious or not, or whatever religious bias we have. Because once again, I believe that fundamentally, the vast majority of humanity seeks the same thing and has the same beliefs and wants good things for themselves and for everyone around them. There are always exceptions. I'm not naive in that sense. There are always minorities of people, small numbers of people in every race, in every culture, in every religion, who are not fundamentally of the same belief. But 99%, and I'm not exaggerating in terms of my belief, I believe it's that high, of people do share those common ideals. So I would like to see a world, and I'd love our children to inherit a world, where a brown-skinned human being could be treated as a human being who could be a bad or good guy, irrespective of their skin color or anything else, but because of what they do.
Well, that's a great note for us to end on. It's simplistic enough, really, when you think about it, that it should be obtainable, but we all know how difficult it's going to be to do that. But it's a vision of a beautiful world. Bassam, thank you for joining us today on The Bottom
Line. Thank you so much, Doug.
Our guest this morning has been Bassam Salam, the CEO and founder of Mindshare Ventures, as well as a senior executive at some of Utah's most interesting companies. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. As always, thank you, Ross. You can hear my entire interview with Bassam on our website, kcpw.org. You can tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.